It's always a great pleasure for me to come to visit here to the City of Light and the home of the Enlightenment. And I hope to say some provocative things that are different from the standard on formation of galaxies today. And so I wish to be enlightened in the afternoon and people to come and tell me what I'm saying that is completely wrong. And I'll learn something. So the subject, I'll just turn the lights off for just a second. The subject is the formation of galaxies. And this is a picture of a little piece of the sky, a little bit smaller than the moon from the Hubble Space Telescope. And you see all the galaxies on it. And I will focus on something like this. A standard elliptical galaxy, and they are very common. Probably half the mass in stars is in galaxies like this. Our kind of galaxy, a little lower mass, the spirals, like say this one, or there's an edge on one and there's a nearby one like that, there are many more of them, but they're somewhat less massive. And to be honest, I think no one, maybe someone in the room, but no one has gotten very convincing theoretical understanding of the formation of spiral galaxies. But I think that we are on the verge of understanding the formation of the giant elliptical galaxies. And since the centers of the normal spirals are like the giant ellipticals, that might be a clue. And the conclusion I've come to is that it's basically in two phases. So I'll say it right now in the beginning, and then I'll give you the details. That there is a phase during which gas comes into the galaxies and they form stars. And it's like what people had talked about many, many years ago, monolithic collapse, but it's gas pouring in and turning into stars. Avishai Dekel has been recently talking about cold flows, but it's always the same idea. Gas comes into the, and then there's a second phase, basically where they eat their companions, and they accrete lots and lots of smaller systems, and they grow from that, and that's the second phase. The work I'm doing with Thorsten Knob and Peter Johansson, whom I met when I was at Cambridge, and then several other people whose names you know who are at Princeton, and these are some of the recent papers that you can see working with them. Okay, so now to the story. The first thing is, what have we learned from observations? And there was a period when the way people did galaxy formation was like the way we do the formation of everything on the Earth. You did it archaeologically. You looked at the nearby objects and you said, what's older and older and older that's nearby? And you reconstructed a history that way. And we knew that from this, that nearby elliptical galaxies were old, they were metal rich, etc. That method went through the 60s and 70s and early 80s, was extremely good. I see some of the older members of the audience, almost my age, know many of the people who are involved in this, but Egeland and Bell and Sandage were examples of that. So it was a method of looking at the fossils, and that gave extremely good information. Then there was a period where people tried to do it by ab initio calculations instead of going backwards from the present to go forwards from the beginning. And those people were brilliant physicists, but they didn't know where to go. So it's as if you start building a tunnel from one side and then you're tunneling from the other side and you don't pay attention that the two sides have to meet someplace in the middle. And so they made models which didn't correspond, and so they were very surprised, for example, by downsizing. Downsizing was the massive galaxies formed earliest. Well, anyone who looked at the nearby universe knew that the massive galaxies formed early. So that there were things that we already knew from the observations, that they form early and grow in size and mass without much late star formation. That has been known for quite a long time. The recent observations by Van Dokkum and others has shown that since redshift 2, they grow in mass by a factor of 2, a typical elliptical like M87, and in size by a factor of 5. So I'm a little too far away from this. Now, major mergers, taking two equal galaxies and combining them to make something else, does it happen? Of course it happens. We see it happening. Is it a common phenomenon? No, it's a fairly uncommon phenomenon. But of course it makes it dramatic. I think the fact that humans are made by major mergers has prejudiced us. So we think we like the idea that galaxies are made by the same process. But in fact, if galaxies eat things, they eat lots and lots of small things. There are more ants than elephants. And if animals eat indiscriminately, they'll eat things that are much smaller than they are. So that's probably a better metaphor than the way humans do it. And we know that since the typical galaxy is a disk galaxy and the disks are fairly fragile, a major merger would destroy them. So a typical disk galaxy hasn't had more than 10% of its mass come in mergers. Dark matter, there's a very simple fact, and that is that if you take the inner parts of elliptical galaxies and you look at the stars in them and say, we can actually count the stars and we know their light and then we know their mass, does it account for the mass that we see dynamically? And the answer is essentially yes, that dark matter is not important in the inner parts of normal galaxies. So it's a fact, whatever our views of the universe are. And another important fact is, if you take a look at the Coma Cluster, which is dominated by elliptical galaxies, it's sitting in gas, and the gas there is more than the mass in galaxies, and that gas has metals. The metallicity of the gas is, and you can see it in the X-rays, you see the X-ray lines, the metals in the gas in the Coma Cluster is as much or more than the metals in the stars in the galaxies in the Coma Cluster. So you know that the galaxies ejected on the order of half their metals. And if you have a theory of galaxy formation that doesn't do that, it's the wrong theory, because it's a fact that galaxies must have ejected a large fraction of their metals. So here are some of the salient points that we know just factually. Well, we also know the, so to speak, initial conditions. This is the microwave background. I'm talking at the home of Planck here. So the locals know more about this than I do, although they won't tell me. François Bouget, is he here? Yes, maybe he'll tell me a little bit later. But this is the initial conditions on the universe. These fluctuations have been amplified by a factor of 10 to the fifth to make it visible, because the actual amplitude is 1 part in 10 to the fifth. And this is the 5-year, there's now 7-year, and of course the Planck observations are much better. But these fluctuations define the initial conditions from which everything formed. So in principle, you could just take these initial conditions, put them in the computer, turn the crank on the computer, and out should come the picture that I started of all the galaxies in the universe. So these fluctuations are very small. One interesting thing is, when they were first shown with COBE, people said, aha, they're just what we expected. And in fact, they weren't. If the fluctuations had, these were fluctuations, were something like a factor of 5 to 10 too low to have grown into the galaxies that we see, unless there's dark matter that amplified them. So there had to be dark matter that grew these fluctuations at this level up to the level that we later see. And then that's one of the things that MOND has to achieve if it's going to give an alternate picture. So this is the details from 2008 of the fluctuations in the sky versus wave number. So this is large angles and this is small angles, and this is the spectrum. And what you can see essentially is that there are many, many more points than there are free parameters, and the spectrum that was the standard lambda CDM spectrum of a universe with a cosmological constant, dark matter, and baryons with a certain amplitude and Gaussian perturbations essentially fits perfectly. And so the assumption of that standard model is that the total amount of matter and energy is the critical value, and the best observations now that are published, Francois could give me better ones, would give this number for the sum of those two. So it's a good approximation to take omega total 1. And of that, the dark matter is 22%, the baryons are 4%. These numbers are a couple of years old, but they haven't changed very much. The lambda is this. The spectrum of fluctuations, this says that it's not exactly k to the minus 1, the spectrum of fluctuations, the amplitude of fluctuations versus the wavelength of the fluctuations. But it's very, very close to that. And a number like this is more or less what was predicted by certain theories called inflationary. The Hubble constant is just what people had gotten by looking at normal galaxies. The amplitude of the perturbations, this says that the fluctuations on a 10 megaparsec scale are about unity in the number of galaxies or anything else you want to measure. So this is the standard model, and this is how well it fits to those observations. So we have by now what is an extremely good paradigm. This is the vanilla-flavored paradigm for cosmology, and the unfortunate thing about it is that it works so well. I wrote papers with Paul Steinhardt in 95, and then later saying, what are the alternative theories that could fit with all of this? And what are the problems with the standard model? And we listed 10 problems. And Martin Rees actually borrowed the slide, and he was using it for a while, where all the problems, and one by one, they've all disappeared. All of the apparent inconsistencies. So maybe someone will tell me some that I don't know about, but all of the apparent inconsistencies with this plain vanilla lambda CDM model have disappeared over time. So for lack of anything better, and you know, Newton lasted for 200 years. This may last for 200 years. Of course, it will be superseded by something better, but it may last for quite a while. Right now, it's getting better and better. So let's see what happens if you start out with this model and just compute forward. This is a standard dark matter simulation. So what you do is you take the fluctuations that you saw in the sky, you put dark matter in, you give it tiny ripples of 1 part in 10 to the fifth, and then just have Newton's laws working. And in fact, you don't need general relativity. Ordinary Newtonian gravity does it perfectly well. And it's astonishing that the fluctuations grow in amplitude to the time when you get to this redshift 0, and it looks like this. So this is a fast forward, and you see this filamentary structure. This would be a rich cluster of galaxies. Now remember, we're only talking about dark matter in this. And was there a question? No. Everyone who does this gets the same result. This is a very important point. There is no discussion on it. There's no controversy. Anyone who does these computational models gets the same. They all like to boast that they're better at this or that or the other thing, but in fact, they're identical. So now, we'll focus on something like this spot. This might be a normal elliptical galaxy, a region of about that halo mass. We're looking at the dark matter that will make a normal elliptical galaxy. So now, what did the calculations we did? We call it the zoom method. You pick a region of interest, like that little box, and you put down a finer grid in that region than you have in the whole region. And then You add the hydrodynamic equations. You add whatever physics you understand well enough to put in, cooling and heating, non-equilibrium ionization, radiative transfer, because the gas gets heated by UV and can absorb and emit, but it's all fairly standard physics, some distribution of sources. When I use a Greek word for heuristic, you know it's not understood. You do something for star formation. But the interesting thing about not understanding star formation is that it doesn't matter. Basically, gas comes into a galaxy and turns into stars. That's the factual. And you use any algorithm that does that, and you get the same results. It might look different in detail if you use different algorithms, but you don't find galaxies which are mostly gas in the center. They don't survive. And you don't find ones which are all gas, all stars. They are typically maintain themselves at several percent gas. And so if you just had an algorithm that everything that falls in turns into stars except a few percent, you'd be getting it right, even if you had no physics behind it. And then you include the tidal forces from the surrounding regions, and you redo the calculation with higher and higher resolution. Now, the important point is redoing the calculation at higher and higher resolution, because if you do it too simply, you may not get the right answer, and you may not know that you didn't get the right answer. So in this is the cartoon version. And here is the Big Bang and nucleosynthesis. So from about here to here, we understand it. And then galaxy formation starts around here. This you can do with linear theory. And here you do the nonlinear simulations. And we're ultimately trying to get something like this and extrapolate back this far and do this part again and again. And so this is what we're trying to make. So we put in gravity, the standard equations, etc. Now, what physics is missing? And it's important that we know that it is. You don't yet know how important it is that it's missing. So, for example, in the fluid in our own galaxy, the cosmic ray pressure is comparable to the gas pressure. It's not included in what I'm doing. In clusters of galaxies, it might be 5 or 10%. So is this serious or not? I can't tell you. Dust physics. We know it's important at low temperatures. It's not included in this. It should be. Magnetic field. Probably the magnetic fields are at least several percent in clusters of galaxies. And in our galaxy, you know the magnetic pressure is comparable to the other pressures. Does that mean everything is wrong? Maybe, maybe not. I don't really know. But it's important that we're not including it. Multiphase media of a hot and cold, the kind of thing I worked on with Chris McKee, is not explicitly included. But insofar as one works at high enough resolution to resolve that, one gets it automatically. So what is the star formation algorithm that we use? If gas is dense, cooling, and collapsing, you make a stellar particle, and you say the mass you make in a stellar particle is something times the mass in gas times the time divided by the maximum of the cooling and the dynamical time. There are many, many refinements of this, but this is basically the algorithm that almost everyone uses. That if you have a little clump of gas, that your fraction of it which could cool and collapse in delta T, you make into a star. Now, what has gotten better from the work of many, many people is getting this constant. And Rob Kennicott is one of the world's experts on this. I think he has talked, or he will talk. Yeah, has many observations. But the bottom line is that this is about 2.5%, that it's a relatively inefficient process. So that this number is now fairly well determined is new. Then you label the particles and go forward using moving them with Newton's laws. So you give each particle the velocity of the gas and follow the dynamics. And then if each particle is a cluster of stars, you can think of it that way, then we know how stars evolve. We know how a globular cluster evolves. The massive stars blow up and produce metals and supernova energy. The lower mass stars, a little lower, produce UV, et cetera, et cetera. So we have the particles do all of that, standard stellar evolution. And this, of course, involves feedback, quote unquote, because when you make stars, then the stars have an output from UV and supernova, which will go into the code and affect other things. So everybody agrees that it's the onset, ionization occurs at redshift 6. The first thesis that I supervised with this, which was Nick Nedden's, got Z equals 6. Everybody has gotten, he did it. I don't think anybody has ever done it and gotten any other answer. Reionization occurs at roughly redshift 6 from the stars that we see. And you can get that either from observations or from the simulations. The high sigma peaks rapidly form into stars from these merging streams. When you looked at the dark matter simulation, you saw that there were these filaments. Well, that was in the dark matter, but there was also gas and similar filaments, and they stream into the centers. And insofar as there's angular momentum, you get disks from that, but you'd get the cores of the galaxies. So this one transparency which is the key to everything that I'm going to conclude. So in this redshift 6 to 2, at that epoch, you have this cold gas flowing in, and you have a very small region, less than a kiloparsec, or about equal to a kiloparsec, in which the gas streams converge and make stars. And you can say this happens in our simulations, or you can see this happens in the sky, because now that they can see galaxies forming at redshift 6, they actually have the sizes of them, and they're extremely compact. They're about a kiloparsec, which is near the resolution of Hubble Space Telescope. The metallicity of these regions very quickly saturates to and becomes supersolar. As you know, if you take a standard closed box and just recycle the gas, the metallicity quickly goes up to the yield, which is the fraction of matter that turns into metals in one generation. And after that, it only changes logarithmically. So it becomes supersolar in metallicity. And the energetics of this phase is dissipational, in the sense that the gas comes in, radiates away its energy, and turns into stars. Then there's a second phase, which overlaps Z equals 2 to 3, in which the formation process is different. There, we already have a galaxy, but it's accumulating stuff from its outskirts. So we see it now with the Magellanic Stream, for example, right now we're accreting it. If you take more massive galaxies, a long time ago people talked about cannibalism, but basically, dynamical friction causes matter to spiral in and be accreted. So it's minor and major mergers. And the scale on this is a factor of 10 larger. It's about 10 kiloparsecs. And it's eating mainly low-mass galaxies. Low-mass galaxies have low metallicity observed, and we can understand why. And so the material that you add at late times, it has subsolar metallicity. That's our galactic halo. The outer parts of our galaxy are the galactic halo. And it's basically accreted stuff from low-mass galaxies and torn them apart. And that we call our halo. Its density is much too low to have formed stars in the outer parts of our galaxy. But you could accumulate things coming in. And this process is conservative in the following sense. If the galaxies are made very far away and they end up here, they must lose energy. And they spiral in, and all the energy that they lose, they have to give to something else. So that process is called dynamical friction. it releases gravitational energy, and that energy goes into pushing out dark matter, stars, and heating the gas. So that's what I mean by conservative. So this is some observational pictures. These are actual pictures of galaxies. At redshift 2 is Mariska Creek. And this is the specific star formation rate. The high rates are blue, and the low rates are red. And you see, even at this redshift, the highest mass things tend to be low star formation rates and red color and compact. They're quite small. And the blue things are actually high star formation rates and very irregular. And you'll see these look like the movies of the forming galaxy. So this is the two phases in front of your eyes from work done at redshift 2.5, which is the overlap time between the two processes. Now, this is a set of simulations where we did this zoom. We took the same box, we called it Halo A, and re-simulated 40 cube particles, 50 cube particles, 100 cube, 200 cube. Almost all the SPH simulations that you've seen are about 40 cubed particles. So if you take the standard calculations that Weinberg or I don't know, many of the people have done, they're about at that level. And they've done big boxes and have many galaxies. We were just doing one galaxy again and again until it converged. So that says it's 4 cubed to 16, is 64, so it's 6 times 10 to the 4th particles. This one has almost 10 to the 7th particles in it. And this is the rotation curve. They're not circular. This is a circular velocity. They're not rotating. They're more or less spherical. So this is just gm over r, the square root of it. And what you find is that when you did it at low resolution, you got a very peaky rotation curve. And this is what everyone else found also. When they did the simulations, they found that the matter came in and gave you a very high concentration of matter in the center, which corresponded to a very high rotation rate. And those were higher than was observed, and the rotation curves weren't flat. They were sort of Keplerian. And you just repeat the simulation again and again, and at 100 cubed, it's like this, and at 200 cubed, it's quite flat, like, it looks as if it's converged to a flat rotation curve at a reasonable circular velocity by the time you've gotten to this resolution. We now have even higher resolution ones, but the effect of convergence, at least we understand, so that you have to go to relatively high numerical resolution before you get results that converged. And this is the star formation rate in that same set of simulations. So this is early times, this is now, and this is the rate in which you're turning gas into stars. And what you find is that it goes up early, and it peaks around redshift, say, 4, 5, 6, and then it declines. And in the 40 or 50 cube ones, it declines to about 5 to 10 solar masses per year of star formation. Well, many people had results like this, and the objection was that, well, we know elliptical galaxies don't have such a high star formation rate, so we must be missing some of the important physics. And so people put AGN feedback in and had many other things that they added, and we thought we would just simply repeat the calculations at higher and higher resolution until they stopped changing. And what we found is at 100 cubed, it starts earlier and goes to a lower value. And at 200 cubed, it goes even earlier and ends up with almost zero, just a couple of solar masses per unit of time. So this is a set of simulations with no feedback in it at all, not even supernova feedback. And yet the galaxy becomes quite red and dead. No supernova, no AGN. And it's just doing it a little bit more carefully. So the question is, why? So why do the results change with resolution? And why was high resolution needed? Now, part of it is the fault of the codes. The mesh codes, in some respects, are better, and Springle's new code is probably better. The SPH codes, which is smooth particle hydrodynamics, has a problem with resolution, and it's technical. I can talk about it later. All codes give you the right result at infinite resolution. So you can always pursue them to higher resolution and see what they converge to. But this was the problem of something called surface tension, that if you had a lump of cold gas, which would actually be shredded up as it came in the SPH codes it didn't, so it went right to the center and turned into stars there. Why does the gas temperature, I'll show you this about the gas temperature, increase even though the cooling time is short and there's no feedback? So why didn't the gas cool? Why was there a dramatic evolution in the size? The galaxies grew a lot. Why is it red and dead early but continue to grow in luminosity? I've given away the answer. So this is on the gas temperature. So I'm plotting here the gas temperature versus radius. So at Z equals 5, this is what the curve looks like. It's cold in the outer parts, 10 to the 4th degrees, and barely gets up to 10 to the 5th. Then as time goes on, the temperature goes up at every place, and at redshift 0, here's the temperature profile, which is very similar to the temperature in a giant elliptical like M87. And we see them, they're very bright in the X-rays. Now, what's happened at every radius, the temperature has gone up, up, up with increasing time. Now, if you had asked for the gas at this radius and this temperature and this density, what is its cooling time? It's less than the Hubble time. We're not putting in any feedback energy, yet it's getting hotter. Is this some trick? No, it's just the ordinary codes. We're just solving the first law of thermodynamics. It's basically that the gas is heated by PdV work, and we'll talk about that in detail. So what is the physics of the convergence? So there's several different processes. And right now, I'll have to explain them in words because for some reason, the movie that's coming in slows up the machine quite a bit. But the gas initially comes in and does cool, just as you'd expect. So in the initial phases, the gas does come in, it does cool as you'd expect, and it turns into stars in the central region. So it's just exactly what you would have thought. Then at later times, there's gravitational heating by dynamical friction. And we'll show you what that is about, but basically, if a stellar lump spirals in to the center, its gravitational energy has to go somewhere, and it goes into heating the gas, it goes into pushing out the dark matter and pushing out the stars, and of course, it replaces those stars. So, and then there's also PdV work. The gas that lands on the outside compresses the inner parts, squeezes it, and heats it by that means. So even if you put in no explicit DQ term, the first law guarantees that the gas will get hotter. So there's the PdV term from the gas being pushed from the outer parts. Since we have the code, we can look in each cell and see what's happening. Why is the temperature going up, not down, even though there's no heating? Dynamical friction, I mentioned. Now, I don't want you to come away from this saying that Jerry Oestreicher said there's no feedback or it's unimportant. I'll be talking other places about the importance of feedback. I think supernovae are extremely important, and AGNs are important. These things really exist. They're really significant, but they are, so to speak, extra wheels. If you don't have them, it all works anyway. It's just it works better if you include these real processes. So I don't want to say these things don't exist. It's just that they're not critical, and if you don't have them, the fundamentals of galaxy formation still work. And now, the next and most important thing that you're going to see from this, there was two things. One was a chart, and the other is a movie. And I think I've pushed it, and it just takes a while for it to come on, because it's something like 500 megabytes. Okay, everything here is a star cluster. So it's a cluster of stars. The color of them, blue is young and red is old. So this is a filament. And what you see is incoming lumps. And these are small galaxies. Here's a somewhat bigger galaxy. And if you watch its orbit, it'll go through, turn around, and come back. Follow this one. You'll see it comes in, goes through, turns around, comes back. When something comes in, you see these blue spurts. And the blue spurts are gas being ejected from the center by tidal forces and turning into stars. Now, if this is, you can then look at this galaxy. We've made an elliptical galaxy. You can look at this galaxy, ask whether the metallicity distribution, the kinds of orbits it has, any kind of measure, the age distribution of the stars in it, they match an elliptical galaxy. And they do. Did you see a major merger of two spirals to make it? Well, there may have been. But it wasn't the dominant feature because there was many other things. Is this simulation a really perfect match to elliptical galaxies? No, it isn't. Probably the baryon, baryons in it are a factor of something like two more than they should be. There's a little bit too much substructure compared to real galaxies. It's good, but it's not perfect. What would we have to do to improve it? I'll describe later. But it has the essential features of making an elliptical galaxy with no feedback whatsoever. Just doing a cosmological simulation rather than a toy problem of a merger at reasonable resolution. Now, this one is the gas in the same case, same simulation. And you see cold gas coming in. The red gas, red is hot gas. So you see this is coming in, cold gas in the center, and you see a big bow shock form. Here's another one coming in, and you see this huge red bow shock that forms. Here's another galaxy coming in, which has cold gas in the center. And so there is always some cold gas. But basically, you're getting this hot bubble. And most of the cold, you can see the cold gas evaporating from it in a tail shock, in the tail behind it, the cometary tail. And that's why not much cold gas gets into the center. This has lost most of its gas. So if you had intuitively said, well, what will happen if the imaginary clouds tries to form into our galaxy? Well, most of the gas will fall to the disk. Imagine the Magellanic clouds trying to form into the center of M87, it would get stripped of everything before it got very far into the center. So on this question of mergers, major or minor, what we did is we did a whole lot of simulations and looked at the average mass ratio for making a galaxy of this mass of the things that fell in. And so what you see is the numbers of 5 to 10%. So the thing that falls in has 5 to 10% of the mass of the thing it's falling into. That's what your eye was telling you from the looks of it in the simulation. Now you say, well, that's not the fair measure. What you'd want is the mass-weighted average, because things that come in with a higher mass give you count more. So this is the mass-weighted average, and there you get 20 to 30%. There's quite a lot of dispersion, as you can see from the dots below it. So it's not very, very low mass mergers that dominate. It's not major mergers that dominate. It's something intermediate. But most of the things that came in are quite small compared to the thing that you finally get out. Then what about the question of the dark matter at the center? Lots of people have made the calculation that if gas comes in to a dark matter halo and cools, then by adiabatic compression, the dark matter will get compressed and density go up. And that's what happens. So this is the mass of dark matter within 2 kiloparsecs. And this is what happens in a dark matter only simulation. It comes in and gets up to a certain level and is more or less constant. Then suppose you did the same thing, but allowed for the gas physics, all the gas physics in star formation. Then you find out that the dark matter density is higher by a factor of several, by redshift 3, than it would have been. That is the adiabatic compression that everybody expected. But then if you go fast forward to redshift 0, you see that the green curve, the highest resolution, is below the red. There was even less dark matter in there than there would have been in a dark matter-only simulation. And so what happened is the dark matter goes up and then it comes down with time, and that's, again, this dynamical friction that's doing it. So here was the way we measured that. Let's just look at the binding energy, gravitational binding energy, of all the stellar particles. And we'll concentrate on the accreted ones. So those had zero binding energy, essentially. They were made very far away. And if they end up bound, then they've released all that energy. So this is the binding energy in the accreted particles, and the end is more than 10 to the 60 ergs. So it's quite a bit. So then you just difference that curve between two time steps, and you get the energy released. And what you see looking at the red curve is a 10 to the 43 to 10 to the 42 ergs per second. So this is the energy released by accreting satellites. And it's a huge amount. It wasn't included in any of the semi-analytic calculations. When I asked somebody doing that, why they don't include it, they said, well, I said, the things you're doing don't conserve energy because you don't include this term. They said, well, we feel we don't have to. And I said, oh, okay. So some of the laws of physics are optional. But the thing about doing the simulations is you may not understand them when you do them, but afterwards, when you look at them, you see things like this, and then you understand them better. So the gravitational energy release is a major component, and of course, the semi-analytic theories are now including this, because it's really there. And it's a major amount, the 10 to the 42 to 10 to the 43 ergs per second. I'm just about done. So we have this two-phase growth, first in situ, in falling cold gas. I mentioned the dark matter increasing and then decreasing. You get metal-rich components in the center of a normal elliptical from the in-situ phase and metal-poor components in the outer parts. So we shouldn't be surprised at the color gradients in elliptical galaxies or the age gradients, because you're adding stars which are older and more metal-poor at late times, so the assembly is very different from the formation. So the stellar system grows in size and time. So this is what we found for the size versus look-back time. So here's r to the half, growing from 1.5 kiloparsecs to, in the end, 3 or 4 kiloparsecs, or in RE growing substantially with as you go towards the present. This is looking at, I found this a very interesting diagram. Every star that you find in the final, or star cluster, you ask when it was formed, and you plot that on this side, and where it was formed. So in units of the virial radius. So this is 10 to the minus 3, it's a little hard to read. 10 to the minus 3 of the virial radius is about a kiloparsec, or less. So all of these stars here were formed at a kiloparsec. All of these were formed at 10 times the virial radius, which is very far outside the galaxy. And then this scale gives the epoch. So what you see, and just look at the bottom figure, is that you had stars formed at very early times, very far out, and stars formed in the center at very early times. Then later on you have a trickle of stars formed in the inner parts at later times. This is a massive galaxy. This would be a galaxy like our own galaxy, where most of it is in the in situ form and less of it is in the accreted form, and you have pretty much a steady formation of stars over time. So this, then if I sum up these curves, I get this. You have really two components, the accreted stars or the in situ stars. For low mass galaxies, the in situ dominates. For massive galaxies, the accreted stars dominate. And they're really distinct. This gives you more detail on, for high mass galaxies, this is when the in situ stars were made. And this is when the accreted stars, this is when the accreted stars were made, this is when the in situ stars were made, and this is when the in situ stars were added. This gives the mean age of the stars, and what you find is that for higher mass stars, higher mass galaxies, the mean age is old, but it gets older and older for the higher mass galaxies. And that you'd get out of simple physics. If you take a higher mass galaxy, it started earlier, it was in a higher fluctuation, delta rho over rho, therefore it started early, therefore the first stars were earlier, and therefore what collects in it is older stars. So we're not surprised at this general trend. This is the velocity dispersion versus mass, and it fits the observations nicely. This is the size, so this is the size distribution of the in situ, and this is the size distribution of the accreted, the total. And so old massive galaxies are bigger because of their accretion of stuff. Now, there were three papers in 1977, one by Binney, one by Silk, and one by Martin Rees and me, and it said there's a definite scale for galaxy formation. All papers agree, and what basically all these simulations say is that that scale is a really important scale. And that's the scale that defines the difference between these two phases. The first phase is when you get up to things less massive than that, and the cooling is dominant. And then after that, the accretion of smaller stellar systems is dominant. The evolution in size, it's apparent, not real. And I won't go through this argument right now because I noticed that I've taken too much time and it's we're over. But if you just use the virial theorem and say you start out with energy one and then you add a lot of stellar systems, and this is the added mass, and the velocity dispersion is some number times the velocity dispersion of the system you had, and just apply the virial theorem, what you get is that the final radius over the original radius is very dependent on this epsilon. And if you have equal mass mergers, then it would go linearly with the mass growth. And if you have very unequal ones, minor mergers, then this epsilon is nearly zero. And then it's a very steep power of the mass. So the surface, the surface density goes as the mass added to the third power. So if they double in mass, it goes down by 1/8 if you're adding low mass things, but it's down by a factor of 2 if you're adding high mass things. So you can actually understand these from rather simple arguments. So I'll just go through the conclusions because I think I've said them. The physical basis is basically those early papers and that the PDV work and TDS work add energy to the gas at that point and it can't contract. And it explains the velocity dispersion and surface brightness of giant ellipticals declining with time, which is the observed fact. Now, again, I'm stressing that feedback from supernova and AGM are real phenomena. They really exist, but they're secondary. And I can talk to you about the results that I have in response to questions about how to include them. Gas inflows early and accretion of satellites late. What's to be done? Do many more cases with higher resolution and see if it works. And this has now been done. We've done it with an AMR code. We get the same results. So there's a check there. Check the two populations prediction. I'm working on that. But you should be able to predict in detail the distribution of globular clusters. There's a there are two populations of globular clusters. One was made in the galaxy, and one was accreted from galaxies being added. That I'm working on with Charlie Conroy. Look at the X-ray properties. That has not been done. These things have not been done. But this has now been done, including the AGN feedback. So I could put a check in this box. I have a very good thesis student working on this. And I'll give you the short form of the conclusion of what it is. The AGN feedback matters a lot for the center of the galaxy and an awful lot for the mass of the black hole. It limits the growth of the mass of the black hole. But it doesn't affect the overall galaxy very much. Recycled gas is quite important. And of course, if you want to convince people, you have to make more movies. So, thank you.